I'm very grateful for that introduction, Madeline. Grateful for your company as well today. Thank you very much. I'd like to acknowledge that we stand on the land of First Nations people. Sovereignty of that land was never ceded. It was taken by force, it's retained by force. I'd like to acknowledge that and adopt with great respect Madeline's acknowledgement of country of the Darug people as well. Hello, welcome. Today we are going to talk about when the rubber hits the road. And that is a funny little metaphor that I've tried to pick up here to essentially get to the crux of when the theory that we're all learning about gets to the practice that a number of us will be engaged in. So there'll be a number of people in here or a number of people listening who are going to be thinking about whether they're going to use their legal studies to go into private practice, to act for clients, that sort of thing, or whether they're going to use their newly acquired legal knowledge to pursue a career in academia, to pursue a career in advocacy, or to, you know, buy a cafe in a beachside town or whatever it might be. The purpose of today's talk is to try to draw the thread from that theoretical side that we've been learning about for some time now and try to give everyone a sense of the practical side, trying to marry those two. So I thought I'd make a couple of initial comments and then get into a number of examples. And it'll be the examples today that are going to be the heart of our discussion, because I feel like for a number of us, a number of the concepts we deal when we deal with when we're studying law can be, while extremely useful and, you know, influential to the way we manage our lives, it can be difficult to get a grip of that theory without getting an understanding of what happens when some facts bump into the theory. And that'll be part of what we're going to be up to dealing with today. So, if I can make some initial comments now. There's a question that plagues graduate lawyers, especially good ones, of how does my knowledge of advanced corporate law, or how do my good marks in advanced real property, or how does my deep research paper in criminology help me when I'm trying to deal with an irate client, or when I'm before a judicial officer and can't seem to be getting my message across? There's that line between the studying of the theory and the application of that theory in practice. And that is a question that a number of us in practice have taken years and years and years to try to confront. And I'm not going to present a solution to that question to you today, but bridging that gap, what I'd like to do today is I'd like to just sort of give voice to that gap and try to give some shape to it, so that if you find yourself in private practice thinking, oh my, university didn't equip me for photocopying three cardboard boxes full of documents for weeks on end or whatever it might be, I thought today might be an opportunity to try to help give shape to that somewhat challenging, in some ways, gap between the theory we learn at university and the practice that we engage in if we elect to go into private practice. So that's what we're going to try to do today, to give shape to that gap between private practice and the theory we're learning. Now, I'll also say today's not going to be a list of strategies or suggestions. Today's going to be an attempt to sketch out a number of different fact patterns for you and to kind of tangle with the law underpinning those fact patterns to sort of give you an old lawyer's view of how some of these decisions can be interpreted, and to give you a sense of some of the facts you might bump into when advising clients in private practice so that you can help them with their issues. A lot of private practice is issue spotting, and sometimes thought of as pattern spotting. Hey, where have I heard a question like that before? You might hear a client making a comment about a certain issue and you might say, oh, bing, that's similar to a decision I might have read in the past or something along those lines. And I'm hoping today's discussion can help you with that sort of issue. So, essentially, we're going to be working through some litigated case studies. Litigated means they've gone to court. Case studies means they're things that happened in real life that we're going to work through and figure out. And we're not going to focus as closely on corporate or company issues today. We will glance past corporations, as any real commercial discussion will need to do. But we're really going to try to get into issues surrounding trusts and issues surrounding partnerships. And sometimes there'll be trusts involving a company and partnerships involving a number of companies and that sort of thing. But what I do want to make clear today is that the goal will be for you to be informed about these broad real-world commercial structures versus fine calibrated corporate issues that you might have been dealing with. As a bit of a disclaimer, the notes I'll be working from and the notes that you have in your iLearn resource are going to include a number of abbreviations that I find useful. You might find them not quite so useful as I find them, so I'll invite you to forgive me for words like D2, which will mean second defendant, for words like BenF, which hopefully makes sense as a beneficiary, and NewCo, which hopefully makes sense as a newly incorporated entity or a new enterprise. And after that, I'm going to try to make some time for answering any questions you might have. Feel free to yell out or interrupt or whatever it might be, that's fine. Also feel free to hold to the end if that's something you would prefer. So, just before getting into our case notes, our litigated examples, I thought I'd give you a sales pitch for why it's good to hear about some case notes so that you can pat yourself on the back for having a listening to the, for having a listen to this or for coming to sit down and hear about this, whatever it might be. Case notes are a helpful way for practitioners, for students, for lawyers of any kind to come to grips with the facts that are confronting judges day in, day out, and how the law interacts with the real world facts that are presented before courts day in, day out, week in, week out. They also, I say, give us an intellectual shorthand. I'm sure there's someone vastly smarter than me who could talk about neural pathways or something like that, that would say that if we've got a set of facts that might be a bit novel, they can help us to understand the underlying concepts. So if we think about your understanding of tort law that may come from a snail in a bottle of ginger beer, if we think about your understanding of contract law that might come from a carbolic smoke ball, these sorts of things, when you've got a novel set of facts, sometimes those set of facts where we're going to talk about some go-karting later, sometimes, you know, we're going to talk about a big pile of granite, sometimes those funny sets of facts can sort of lead you to say, oh yeah, hang on, what was going on with that carbolic smoke ball? What was going on with that big pile of granite or that big pile of gabbro, as we might learn about later? My hope is that I'm going to equip you with one or two more of, I'll use a word that I've got no idea, use a phrase, I don't know if it's a definition, neural pathways, if I can say that again. I'll hope to equip you with a couple more of those today that might assist you for thinking through some of these more complex issues that judges are forced to confront. Also, a lot of these decisions are pretty recent, so the last 2 and a bit years. So the goal is to equip you with what's actually happening day to day, week to week, in firms of the kind that I formerly worked at until recently, are confronting day in, day out, week in, week out. And so I might turn to the first case I've got in your paper that you might be able to find in iLearn. And this is a case that deals with partnerships. And as we know, just to sort of retrace some of the steps that you will have been dealing with in this course and indeed in some others as well, a partnership is a sort of special contractual relationship between individual legal entities. A partnership is not an entity in and of itself, like a company. I'll try to keep the company mentions as low as I can. It is instead a relationship between legal entities and can, and indeed in this case to an extent did include a partnership between a number of companies as well. And so, if I can set the scene for you to try to sketch out these facts for you to understand, we are at a quarry. And this quarry deals with granite or gabbro, which are terms that are treated as interchangeable in the judgment, and so I'll just defer to their honour in relation to the interchangeability of those two things. And gabbro or granite is what you and I might think of as that attractive looking stone that'll sometimes form the top of kitchen benches or whatever it might be. So there we are at a quarry, and the quarry does whatever a quarry does, dig into the ground or explode the ground or whatever it might be, in order to unearth some of this granite. And so what we find when we unearth this granite is we find some first grade granite, first grade gabbro, and that first grade is what we might think of as the most commercially useful grade, you know, a big bit that we can quickly chop and change into a kitchen bench top, or, you know, turn into a fireplace or whatever it is we might do, something we can quickly put to commercial use. That's first grade. And second grade gabbro is gabbro that is much less immediately useful. It's in kind of smaller bits and contains impurities, and it has a much more variable value. So the price you'll get for second grade granite today might be zero. The price you get for second grade granite next week might be much higher due to the fluctuations in the market. And so if I can set the scene, what we have is this quarry where we're digging in the ground or we're blowing things up. As soon as we find some first grade gabbro, we're throwing it on a truck or a train or whatever, we're getting it out of there into the marketplace. When we find some second grade granite or second grade gabbro, what we're doing is we're throwing it at a big stockpile over there. And you know, if we have a rough year or if the value increases or whatever it might be, we might dip in to that second grade granite, second grade gabbro, or we might not. We're just building that stockpile. That is the nature of the venture. So they're the set of facts that I'd like to plant in your head to help you understand some of these concepts. Welcome. And so we've got this quarry operating in that form, and we have a dispute today. And there's a dispute brought by the plaintiffs. And you'll know they're bringing the dispute because they have the name plaintiffs. They're the people who've come to court. They're the people who've made an application to seek some certain forms of orders. And the plaintiffs today have made an application to seek orders in relation to partnership accounts. The nature of those orders is to say, that an indebtedness arises from the defendants to the plaintiffs in respect of a number of different sets of accounts and sets of monetary claims that ought to be payable via the partnership. Let me set that out in a slightly more digestible fashion. The plaintiffs were partners in the business operating at the quarry from 1996 to 2003. Before 1996, there were various other business structures operating. Some of them were partnerships between natural persons. Some of them were partnerships between companies. Some of them were partnerships between natural persons and companies. Some of them were partnerships between companies in their capacity as trustees, etc. The partnership we're dealing with was the partnership that operated from 1996 to 2003. In 2003, the partnership ended. One partner dropped out, a number of other partners came in. And so following 2003, there are other business structures who go on to operate the quarry on the site. What our plaintiffs today say is that the account to be made in respect of the 1996 to 2003 partnership needs to be passed. And in order for the account to be passed, the assets of the partnership need to be dealt with appropriately. That might sound a bit fiddly, so we'll work through it again. Partners are entitled to an account of the assets of the partnership once it is dissolved. Our plaintiffs say, hey, when that partnership was dissolved, we didn't get all of the assets. You need to go back, you need to get those assets, and you need to pay them to us. Welcome, good to see you. No. And so those assets include, what is alleged is that the assets of the partnership, the plaintiffs say, those assets include a right to use the quarry as an asset of the partnership. And those assets include the second grade gabbro. And you might recall that this gabbro is being stacked up higher and higher into the air. And what our plaintiffs say is that that pile of second grade gabbro, whenever the market turns and there's going to be a market for it, that also belongs, or some of it belongs, to the 1996 to 2003 partnership. Now, the challenge we're going to get to is, I'll just refresh your memory, that from the start of this quarry in the 1960s or so up to about 2017, 2018, the business of the quarry was to go into the, you know, dig up from the ground or blow up or whatever it might be, get the first grade granite, first grade gabbro, ship it out, make the money, get the second grade gabbro, throw it in a big pile over here. And so we're building the pile of second grade gabbro from 1960 to 2018, and the partnership is doing that from 96 to 2003, But the challenge the plaintiffs are going to encounter is attempting to surgically get into which part of this stockpile is going to be attributable to the partnership. So we're going to come to that challenge shortly. Let me refresh your memory that the plaintiffs are seeking to pass accounts of the partnership on the basis that there are still things that belong to the partnership that need to be distributed amongst the partners. That first thing was the right to use the property as a quarry. That is a valuable right, and what the partners say is that right is an asset of the partnership. The court, with great respect, has little difficulty disposing of that argument on the basis that the right to use the property as a quarry is the right of the owners of the property, and the partnership merely enjoyed a license to make use of that right, essentially a sub-license, as was eventually found, which the partnership did make use of, indeed in going in and blowing up and collecting and distributing the granite or the gabbro and then making the pile of the second grade granite and gabbro as well. So the first passing of accounts effort that the plaintiffs attempted to bring falls down on the basis that the alleged, I withdraw that, the claimed right of the partnership was not a right of the partnership at all, but an actual right of the owners of the land. And just from a practical perspective, I might just give you a bit of background as to why that could have been so confusing. Over the years, these various entities related to linked family members, and at the conclusion of each set of partnerships and whatever, one partner would drop out and a new partner would come in. So it was not as if there were completely alien brand new arrangements. There was a rhythm of one or two dropping out of the partnership from 1960 to 1965. One partner would leave, a new one would join. Then it would be the same partnership, 65 to 75. Then someone would die. And then the partnership from 75 to 85 would be slightly differently constituted. So the fuzziness with which the various relationships between the parties was dealt with led to the plaintiffs asserting that the ownership of the property could be characterised as property of the 96 to 2003 partnership. So it's easy to be critical sometimes in hindsight when you're reading a judgment to say, oh, that's ludicrous or whatever it might be. I haven't given you that information early enough. I've given it to you now. So you might be able to see where that, on one view, confusion of the plaintiffs might have arisen from. Something worth bearing in mind, perhaps. And so, first asset the plaintiffs are after, they fail in their claim. The second asset is, hey, what about all our second grade gabbro over here? And the challenge the plaintiffs have is the challenge that's already become clear to you in your mind as you think about it, is how on earth are we going to go through this big pile of second grade granite, second grade gabbro, and figure out what slice of it is attributable to the 96 to 2003 partnership versus the amount that's attributable to all the structures that came before 1996 and all the structures that followed 2003. And essentially the court comes to the position that there's no evidence before it to assist it on the basis, to assist it with forming a view as to what of that second grade gabbro is attributable to 96 to 2003 versus the other areas. And so with no evidence to assist it on that basis, there's some preliminary suggestions of measurements done by footsteps and this sort of thing. And if we imagine it, you know, one can imagine a sort of archaeological, you know, almost one of those sedimentary rock kind of diagrams. But there's nothing of that that is compelling to the court, and nothing that convinces the court to make the orders the plaintiffs seek. And so what we find in this matter is the plaintiffs who said, hey, I want some more of these 96 to 2003 assets paid to me. They fail. They fail to have the right to use the quarry asset paid to them because they can't prove it was an asset of the partnership. They fail to have our part of the second grade gabbro asset paid to them because they can't convince the court that there is a severable part of that pile of second grade gabbro that is payable to them. Told you it'd be good fun. Good stuff. So let's jump from a granite quarry, a gabbro quarry, off to a farm. And this is a farm that was operated in what we might think of as a reasonably traditional patriarchal sort of structure, where dad was operating the farm and was the owner of the farm, and there were a number of structures in place in relation to it. Now, Dad was the operator of the farm at various times, including in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, the tax landscape of the relevant farm included death duties. And these death duties were at levels that the court describes as confiscatory. And the reason that description is used is because you may have a farmer who passes away. Sorry, let me start that again. The death duty is applied to the estate of someone who passes away. And so you may have a farmer who passes away, and that farmer might have $50 in their back pocket and then be the owner of a farm of some considerable value. So death duty is applied to farm of considerable value plus $50. And the death duty that is applied is so large as to require the sale of the farm in order to pay it, if that makes sense. So the death duty is described by the court in this judgment as confiscatory. The structure adopted by many farm owners in the past, and some farm owners today, in order to manage the risk of the confiscatory death duty, is to incorporate a trustee company and transfer ownership of the farm out of the hands of, in our example, Dad, and into the hands of Dad Co. Pty Limited as trustee for the blah blah family trust, such that when Dad dies, there's no big scary death duty to be applied, and the family, speaking broadly, can maintain control and can continue to exert an income from the farm. The asset isn't subject of a confiscatory death duties regime. The asset can instead be subject to the various tax advantages that fall from setting up a family trust regime. We can have a discussion about the politics of death duties and family trust tax regimes at another time. But in any case, this was the structure set up at the time. Or was it? And so let me just plant that seed for you. So we may come back to that. Dad dies in the late 70s, and all of Dad's assets pass to Mum. And so Mum becomes the owner of everything that was Dad's on his death. Time passes, and Mum and Dad have a number of kids. One of those kids continues to operate the farm that is owned by the trustee company over the years. Now, Mum dies in 2017, and there are a number of estate disputes, we might just describe them loosely that way, that arise in respect of Mum passing away. And one of those is the suggestion that the farm passed by Dad's will into Mum's hands. Put another way, the farm was never transferred from Dad to Dad Co. Pty Limited. Instead, the farm remained in Dad's hands, and so when Dad died, it passed to Mum. And so now Mum's dead, it passes to us, is what is suggested. Now this suggestion is a challenging one for the parties to deal with. And I should just give a slightly sad footnote that there are a number of disputes about this estate. They were costly and indeed turned out to be confiscatory in and of themselves. The legal fees involved with these various proceedings required the farm to be sold in any case. So there's a bit of a tragedy in there. Charles Dickens line is about the estate dispute that ends up gobbling up the estate. And we can sort of chuckle away, but there's a sadness to that as well, but we can leave that for another time. Schooner Talk is my first mentor as a law firm. One of my early mentors might have described it. And so we have this position where the children who are hoping to become the owners of the farm are asserting, hey, it was Mum's farm, so it falls into Mum's estate, so it comes to us. And so what is required of the court is to jump in their time machine and to head back and say, well, this question really is, did Dad effectively transfer the farm out of Dad's hands and into Dadco Pty Limited's hands way back in the late 1970s. The evidence traverses some interesting things, including this sort of handy young lawyer who advises on the sale, who went on to become a barrister, who went on to take Silk. And so, you know, there's quite a useful, reliable set of notes that can be derived from this then sort of young, you know, bright, switched on lawyer who sort of ran the transaction. There's evidence about, over the years following Dad's death, the farm being treated as an asset of the trust, and all of the children sort of more or less deferring to the treatment of the farm as an asset of the trust over time. And in short, despite the fact Mum, the grant of probate of Mum's estate values her estate at 12.5 million, which includes the farm, the court comes to find that the asset was indeed effectively transferred by Dad in the late 1970s, so does not fall into Mum's estate, and so remains the property of Dadco Pty Limited and in the hands of the trustee. That case is one that I hope has a set of facts that will be slightly evocative for you. And it's one that I think highlights when we talk about commercial relationships, when we talk about business structures, it's sometimes difficult to project into the future of just how useful a business structure is likely to be. And so in this case, Dad did, quote, the right thing, if we can speak in broad terms, to achieve his goals in the late 1970s. Dad's goals were, I want this to benefit my family without death duties being paid. Check, Dad did that. I think in time, at least the plaintiff in this application would say, well, despite the benefit of the absence of death duties in the 1970s, I now take the view that a restructure at some stage would have been closer to what would have been of more benefit to the family. And so I wanted to give you the example of that case when we're talking about the discussion of when the rubber hits the road, of saying, well, if you're in practice and your instructions from Dad in the 1970s are, hey, set this up for me so we avoid death duties, you did your job 11 out of 10, congratulations. And then the challenge is thinking down the line, or, you know, perhaps being Mum's lawyer in the 1990s or the early 2000s, when sort of these issues might be kind of looming into view. These are the sort of things in private practice where the line between the theory of how trusts work and how tax works and all that sort of thing comes into the face of your client, who might be Mum, who might have one kid operating the farm and might have in mind how to plan for the future. So I find that to be a useful case, perhaps, to illustrate for you where the rubber hits the road, if I lean heavily on that metaphor of what happens when that theory that everyone obviously had a good command of came to hit the practice of just how are we going to do this. I'll take you now to our third case. And this case involves a large entity, a large sum. So this is a superannuation fund with an asset pool of about 10.5 billion at the time of the handing down of the judgment. And the nature of those assets were they were reasonably sort of conservatively invested, as we might expect, and they were operated by the trustee themselves. If I can just linger on that point for a moment, the trustee of the fund did not outsource the management of any of the assets in the fund. Instead, the trustee did all the management work themselves. And in relation to that management work, the trustee would be moving around substantial amounts of assets, and there'd be times when the trustee would sort of bump into regulations and that sort of thing, where occasionally there'd be fines of some size that would have to be paid because there'd be some regulation breached. And subject to the trust deed, the trustee would enjoy what we call an indemnity from the trust assets in respect of that. So the trustee, subject to the trust deed, could reach in to the pool of trust assets and say, whoops, I've just been fined $20,000 in respect of breaching regulation 123 of the blah, blah. And so I'll just pay that out of this sum in accordance with the trust deed. Now, importantly, the Hayne Royal Commission happens. And Madeline, you'll have had a chance to speak about that with all of you at some length, I'm sure. And what happens from the Hayne Royal Commission is a large number of things. Most of them I have zero awareness of, but one of them is that a lens is applied to indemnity clauses of this kind, and it is apparent that the trustee may not be able to rely on this indemnity into the future, and thanks to the Hayne Royal Commission, it appears more likely that there will be some more potential regulations and potential offences the trustee might engage in that might be, you know, little tick-attack, quote-quote, minor offences, if I can speak perhaps a little flippantly, but they may nonetheless arise, as they had done for the trustee in the past, and the trustee wanted the opportunity to be able to pay these off. Now, alongside this is the actual operation of the fund, where, as I say, the trustee doesn't outsource anything, so there's no indemnity from a service provider or anything like this. It will be the trustee's liability themselves. The trustee has $6 in assets in their own name. So if they are fined $500 for a parking infringement and they are unable to be indemnified from the trust assets, then bang, they are placed into, well, they ought to be placed into liquidation. And what that's going to do is unravel the $10.5 billion superannuation structure, because you're going to have the trustee of this fund that's going to be wound up. You're going to need to appoint external administrators. You're then going to need to incorporate a new trustee. You're probably going to need to get approvals pursuant to Section 411 of the Corporations Act, and then a number of scary superannuation regulation-y things that are outside of my expertise. And so the trustee comes before the court to seek what we call judicial advice. And judicial advice is coming before the court essentially to ask a yes-no question. And it's the sort of application that can be made by trustees, and liquidators and bankruptcy trustees and executive estates and these sorts of people. They can come before the court and put forward a proposed course of action, put forward evidence in support of that proposed course of action, and then the court may give a yes-no response. And I'm speaking a little loosely when I call it a yes-no response, but that's essentially the nature of the advice that's offered. And if the advice is given by the court, and the trustee or the liquidator or whomever goes ahead in reliance and in accordance with that advice, then the trustee or the liquidator obtains protection in respect of any criticism of their conduct that might arise from the giving of that advice. And so what we have today is we have the trustee coming to the court, giving evidence of everything we've just discussed now. Hey, if I get wound up, this whole thing's going to crumble into dust. Worried about the Hayne Royal Commission, worried about all this new stuff coming in. I've only got $6 to my name. Can I please amend the trust deed to allow me to be indemnified in some other way that is using the funds that have essentially been set aside? It's an amendment to the trust deed essentially to deal with this issue. And what the court does is give the advice in the form that the trustee seeks. That's sort of the end of the decision, but I thought we might just reflect on that for a moment. Because if we're riffing on this theme of when the rubber hits the road, the theory is, oh yeah, sometimes trustees can come to the court and get judicial advice. And that's kind of the end of the theory of that case. But if we bump into the practice, I mean, it took me a few minutes to work through the facts, and I say, I hope you agree, because they took a little while for me to figure out. There's some complexity to the facts. There's some complexity to the practice that you will be bumping into when and if you elect to go into private practice, and the way those facts of some complexity are going to engage with the theory you're learning. And so on one view, the law of that case is supremely easy. Yeah, the court can give that advice if it wants. But on another view, it's a reasonably complex piece of litigation, notwithstanding the fact that there are no other parties involved. And so I hope it was sort of a useful example for you to sort of see where sometimes the theory can feel quite ethereal. Oh yeah, the court can give advice to trustees. But then seeing how that happens when the rubber hits the road can be quite illustrative. Illustrative. Let's do that. We're going to turn to case four, if that's all right. Come and I said I'd avoid speaking about corporations, and I will, it almost entirely, but this is a case we're going to discuss a bit by analogy to something available to corporations. So I'm going to dive into a bit of corporate law, but I'm then going to use it to pivot out to some trust law. So, you know, it's going to be good fun. We'll get through it together, I promise. So, a derivative action. Let me refresh your memory on what that is. You all studied what a derivative action is before, but we'll just hold each other's hand to make sure we fully understand perfectly. We have a company, and that company has shareholders, and those shareholders might be disappointed with the manner in which the company is conducting itself. Some of those frustrations of the shareholders or disappointments of the shareholders may be in relation to the conduct of the directors. So if we take a real basic example, James Pty Limited might have the director of James and might have two shareholders, James and Madeline. And James, the director, might be sucking cash out of James Pty Limited, and Madeline, the shareholder, is just watching this cash being funneled out of James Pty Limited, saying, I'm a shareholder of this company and I'm watching it just be torn to shreds by this guy. The challenge is, Madeline as shareholder has no claim in that scenario. James, the director, has not wronged Madeline at all. The director has only wronged James Pty Limited. So the only appropriate person to bring a claim is James Pty Limited. And so the Corporations Act, and before that the common law, gave people in the position of Madeline to apply to, speaking loosely, stand in the shoes of James Pty Limited to then go and pursue this guy James for ripping all the money out of the company. Let's work through that once more. If you're the shareholder in a company and someone's done wrong by the company, you can stand in the shoes of the company to pursue that wrongdoer. So let's turn to trust law. This case is striking. It's called Gillespie Cranes, 2002. It's a decision of Justice Parker. It'll be in your notes. It is, I say with great respect, an enlargement of a number of practitioners' understanding of the rights and remedies available to beneficiaries of trusts. And the very short version of that enlargement is, with thanks to this judgment, it has become clear that a derivative action is available to beneficiaries of trusts in a very similar way to the way that a derivative action is available to shareholders of companies. So if I can just work that through with you, before this judgment, it was not clear whether the beneficiary of a trust could bring an application on behalf of that trust for a wrong done to that trust. Right, so if we run that scenario again, let's say Madeline and James are beneficiaries of the Macquarie Trust, and that James is the trustee of the Macquarie Trust, and James has sucked all the funds out of that trust. The response to Madeline, who might complain about that, is, hey, you've got a number of applications you can make, including attempting to remove James as trustee, but it is the trust's assets that have been taken. And so it's the trust's claim to bring, and so it is for the trust to pursue those lost assets. And there is no scope for you to stand in the shoes of the trustee in order to bring an application to chase those funds. And I'll repeat, with great respect, this case has clarified and enlarged and progressed a number of practitioners' understanding of that position to say, that is not the case. The previous understanding has now been clarified, and a beneficiary can bring an application to stand in the shoes of the trust in order to pursue a claim that has been alleged on behalf of the trust. So let's dive into the facts of this one. We're dealing with some entities of substantial assets today. Jiminy Cricket. So the trust had assets of around about $120 million at its peak. A number of those assets were property, some of which were compulsorily acquired over time. We have trustees who, I withdraw that, we have a trustee, and the trustee is a company controlled by two of the trust's beneficiaries. It's a trust set up by Dad in the 1970s, a theme we're returning to, and the beneficiaries include Mum and I think it's four kids. And two of the four kids, who we are going to refer to loosely and perhaps a bit flippantly as the bad guys, set up a trustee company, and I use the term bad guys just merely for convenience and without criticism or comment at all. They set up the trustee company, and they caused the trustee company to make a number of decisions and take a number of actions. One of those decisions is to make no distributions to beneficiaries from the year 2009 to 2020 in what our plaintiff alleges is in breach of the trust deed, and what would appear to be a breach of the trust deed. And so the beneficiaries say, hey, you've made distributions to these other parties, but you should have been making distributions to us, and your failure to do that is a breach of the trust deed. It's claim one, or that's that describes one bunch of claims that the plaintiffs are seeking to agitate. Another bunch of claims, if I can speak loosely, include the transfer of a valuable crane business out of the hands of the trust into the hands of a company related to our two bad guys. And so the trust's crane business that's worth around about $50, $55 million is transferred out of the hands of the trust and into the hands of a company related to our bad guys. And what is said by our plaintiff today is, I also want to sue for that. And let's just think that through for ourselves. The first sort of bunch of claims are claims beneficiaries can make to say, hey, you didn't distribute this money that I was entitled to. And that is rightly characterized as a claim of the beneficiaries. That second claim that says, hey, you transferred these assets out of the hands of the trust when you shouldn't have, that's actually a claim of the trust. That's not a claim of the beneficiaries of the trust. And so the plaintiff, in a similar position to the shareholders in a company who've had a director, steal some, we use the term steal loosely, steal some money, say, well, this is a situation where leave ought to be granted to us to stand in the shoes of the trust, much in the way a derivative action would do, to stand in the shoes of the trust in order to go and pursue the bad guys or the entities related to the bad guys in respect of the transfer of this business. And as I said before, I don't want to labour the point too much. If you had suggested to me before I read this judgment that that was a possibility, I would have said I don't agree. Justice Parker's clarified this to say, yes, this is a case where the beneficiaries of this trust can come and step into the shoes of the trust and can come and pursue the, firstly, the trustee company for breach of their trust, but with respect, perhaps more importantly, the Barnes and Addy, the final recipients, the knowing receipt defendants of this company. And I might just linger on that point for a moment, sorry. So a beneficiary might sue a trustee for a breach of their trustee obligations, but that trustee, as we learnt with our previous case, might be worth $6. And so they might only have $6 to pay you for the $55 million crane business they transferred. And so what the beneficiaries really want is to go and pursue the end point. Using the word tracing slightly loosely is to use sort of Barnes and Addy in similar cases where there has been knowing receipt, where there has been receipt by a party that they know is the subject of wrongdoing. So the beneficiaries don't really care about suing the trustee. The beneficiaries want to get to the ultimate recipient of the $55 million crane company and various related assets. And the court says, yeah, that's a possibility. Let's set a date for hearing in future. And so I hope that's an example, when we're talking about rubber hitting the road, of what we might say, perhaps even flippantly, in theory, of, oh, hey, do you know beneficiaries can bring derivative actions as well? And that might be a one-sentence comment. And I hope today we can sort of see how a little one-sentence throwaway like that can then have facts sort of layered on top of it to understand it. Alan,
sorry, just a quick
please.
Question. The reason why this is the case is because the trustee is a corporate trustee, so it's under the realm of the Asset Corporation Act. If the trustee was a natural person, it cannot be done through this way because the journey is, because the trust is only a legal structure, it's not an identity entity itself.
Perfect question. That question gets to the absolute heart of the question. The answer is no to that. I might just repeat that question. So the question was, is the only reason leave was granted to pursue the trustee company was because it was a company. And so because the Corporations Act applies to companies, and so that outcome would have been different for a natural person. The answer to that is no. If the trustee was a natural person, then the natural person would have been able to be pursued. And that is, I say with great respect, the novel issue that arises from this case. Because I would have agreed with you absolutely entirely until reading this case.
And a follow-up question on that. Okay, now, if for a derivative action, the benefit is the company will pay for the legal charges?
Often, yes.
Often.
Often.
I mean, with my shallow knowledge.
Yeah.
If the trustee was a natural person, who will bear the legal charges?
Yes, so... Well, probably it'll be our knowing receipt defendants, right? So let's assume our trustee is what is sometimes called a person of straw, has $6 in their back pocket. You'd seek the cost orders against them, surely, but I think you'd want to be seeking cost orders against your knowing recipient defendants. Precisely. Absolutely, precisely. And so, like, I'd like to linger because that really gets to the heart of this topic. Because as I say, my answer would have been different 18 months ago. And so the idea of a beneficiary stepping in to defend or pursue the corpus of a trust rather than pursuing the assets of a corporation in the role of a shareholder is, I say with great respect, new to me and something to add to the arsenal of a lawyer in practice dealing with this area. So let's turn to case five. Yeah, let's turn to case five quickly. Case five relates to go-karts. I think I promised some go-karts at the start. So let's go hard at those go-karts now. We've got a national body that we're just going to loosely call Go-Kart Australia. I think that's not the actual name, but it doesn't matter. And Go-Kart Australia is the national body, as I say. And there are a number of state bodies that operate go-karting races. And what happens if Go-Kart South Australia wants to operate a race? They want it to be certified by Go-Karting Australia, so they will take a clip from each go-kart driver, which they'll then pay on to Go-Kart Australia. Go-Kart Australia will take all this money into their coffers, and they will record it, and sometimes they will make loans back to each of the state bodies in order for those state bodies to build new go-kart tracks in order to have new Go-Kart Australia accredited go-kart races on. And so we've got money flowing out from the states to the national body, and we have the national body purporting to hold those funds on trust. The relationship between one of these state go-karting bodies, I think it's Go-Kart New South Wales, begins to crumble a little bit. The relationship between Go-Kart New South Wales and Go-Karting Australia falls down. And Go-Kart New South Wales says, nah, we'll take that money back now. Thanks. We'll have that clip. Go-Kart Australia says the exact opposite. Go-Kart Australia says, you're leaving the membership of Go-Kart Australia. That is a breach of the terms of which we provided finance for some of your go-kart tracks. So pay back those loans and pay back the interest that we weren't going to charge you for so long as you complied with the terms of this finance arrangement. Claim and cross-claim. In short, Go-Kart Australia loses. The reason Go-Kart Australia loses is, in short, because of the evidence for Go-Kart Australia losing is, in short, the nature of the annual accounts that Go-Kart Australia signed off on each time. And if I can drill down into a really simple explanation of that. Each year, Go Kart Australia would have accounts prepared, and each year, the management committee of the trust or the directors of Go Kart Australia would sign off and say, you know, these are the true and accurate accounts of this for this year. And those accounts reflected assets, beneficial assets of that trustee company of $1, and sums held on trust for the South Australia Go Kart, for the New South Wales Go Kart, for the Queensland Go Kart, of the various sums paid in as a clip that were collected. So these sums represented, the court eventually found, represented distributions made by Go Kart Australia in its capacity as trustee that were then held on bare trust. And again, this is one trust distributing to another trust, and I know we might get a bit inception on this, but essentially they're trust distributions that Go Kart Australia was trying to hold on to, that the court said, similar to a Saunders and Vautier direction made in a wills and estates capacity, that the beneficiaries of this trust had said, we want the money. And so the court said, that's a pretty natural claim for money had and received in the hands of the trustee. And the court said, Go Kart Australia, you've got to go and pay the money. That's a little fuzzy. Let's finish with an easier one. Let's finish with the easiest of all, the one we can all empathise with. I'm jumping ahead to case 8. This is a 2021 decision about a lost trust deed. I think we can all empathise with losing an old piece of paper. And these applications come up from time to time where you'll have a trustee, or you might have a new trustee appointed, or you might have directors of a trustee appointed who will say, I'm sure the words, oh fuck, will start the sentence. I'm like, oh fuck, have you got the trust deed? And of course, the last time you needed it was in 2006 when the trust might have bought a piece of property, or 2011 when it might have opened a new bank account, and since people have moved house or changed accountants or whatever it might be. And somewhere in that process, the original of the trust deed is lost. And so what on earth are we going to do? The answer to that is we're going to return to section 63, which we referred to earlier, is we're going to seek judicial advice. And you'll remember judicial advice is our sort of yes-no question. And the nature of that yes-no question here is essentially the trustee coming before the court to say, hey court, is it okay if I administer the trust pursuant to these terms, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, essentially putting before the court a copy of the trust deed. And indeed, that's what happened here, to say, hey, we've lost the original. Here's a copy of the deed that we've been administering the trust pursuant to through this time. Is this okay? To spoil the answer, the court said yes. The basis for that is the court was able to conclude, based on the evidence before it, that there was an original trust deed in that form at some stage. And what was interesting was that part of the evidence of that was the court taking judicial notice of something. And I think you might have dealt with judicial notice, maybe in evidence or in litigation, something like that. Judicial notice, as you almost certainly know, is when a court accepts as factual something which is not proved by evidence. And so a court will take judicial notice of things that might be thought of as common sense. And so you might not have to prove, for example, how a hyperlink works if you come and click on it. You might not have to prove that a red light, that people traditionally stop when it's a red light. You might not have to prove that over a long period of time, real property prices in residential areas are likely to increase. You might not have to prove some things you might think of as fairly common sense. And here, what the court takes judicial notice of is that a bank, in opening up a new account for a trustee company, will need to see an original copy of the trust deed. And so the court had evidence that the bank had indeed opened this bank account. And the court said, well, we take judicial notice of the fact that a bank's not going to open a new bank account without having seen the original. And so the fact of the bank opening the account itself was sufficient for the court to say, oh yeah, there was an original in this form at some time. And so that, combined with other evidentiary points that you can enjoy from the paper, was sufficient to set out for the court and indeed for it to give the judicial advice sought by the trustee, who was then empowered to go and administer the trust pursuant to the copy of the trust deed. That's the last example I'm planning to raise in this discussion. I'd like to just return to our theme for about 30, 60 seconds or so if I can. It's about when the rubber hits the road. Today we've dealt with some pretty fiddly rubber, if we lean on that metaphor a little bit. You know, weird trustee applications, great big superannuation funds responding to royal commissions, stuff that can feel a bit fuzzy, trustee derivative actions. And hopefully I've equipped you with a tiny bit of an understanding that the theory perhaps becomes even easier to understand if we can hang on to some real practical, factual examples about, well, what does, you know, a set of accounts for some go-karting organisation really mean in practice? Well, the answer to that is it can be some of the most important elements of a claim you are bringing or your client is bringing. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and to wish you the very best when the rubber hits the road in your own career.